Good. So just sitting comfortably for a few minutes before we meditate again. So some of you were here last week. Who was here last week? So majority of you. Last week when we meditated, I suggested that we meditate in a slightly different way. We do the metta bhavana in a slightly different way. What I was suggesting, and I'm going to suggest it again this week, is that we approach the practice afresh. It's very easy to get stuck in habitual kind of ways of practicing. And particularly we approach it by emphasizing the receptive dimension of meditation. Meditation has a sort of receptive dimension and a more active dimension. In the receptive dimension, it's a bit like, well, Keats talked of negative capability, didn't he, where you're just trying to suspend willing for a while. You're just opening up to experience. Experience is all that we have. Life is all around us. We are having experience all the time through all of our senses. And in the receptive dimension, you sort of have an attitude of patient noticing, waiting, turning towards your experience with a friendly, kindly awareness. But you're not trying to change your experience, you're just turning towards it. Do you see what I mean? And if you do that, then sometimes, actually, what happens is that your experience does change and it unfolds in a richer, deeper, more meaningful way. That happens particularly if you're already relatively concentrated. It's not great, or it's not likely to happen so much, if your mind is very active and busy. If your mind is very active and busy, then you probably do need to do some effort, make some effort to calm the mind a bit more. You could do that by watching the breath, for example, following the breath as you do in the mindfulness of breathing. You could do that by becoming aware of the sensations in the belly, again, as you might do in the mindfulness of breathing, or the sensations in the legs and the lower half of the body generally. Focus on the body, and the mind will become gradually more still. So if your mind is very distracted, and you notice that, then do make some effort to become a little bit more still. But otherwise, if you're relatively still in your mind already, then see if you can just watch your experience. Watch the sensations in your body. Particularly watch them in the belly and around the centre of your chest, the heart centre. You don't need to try and change them. On the other hand, the attitude with which you watch them is really important. You want to be patient. You want to be friendly. So whether your experience is the sort of experience you like and want, or whether it isn't, you try and just turn towards it with a friendly gaze. You're patient, you're not trying to push it away. There's a sort of non-judgmental attitude to it. You're allowing your experience to be what it is, without critical kind of appraisal. If you find yourself being critical of your experience or telling yourself off, then that's not very helpful. But if you do find, sometimes we have a critical voice, don't we, in our heads, saying, well, all sorts of things, I'm not going to rehearse the critical voice for you. If you notice that critical voice, well, notice that with kindness and friendliness. Include that in the experience that you're becoming aware of. Yeah? So, for example, although a critical voice isn't very helpful, don't then tell yourself off for having a critical voice. because then you'd get critical about being critical, and you could carry on like that forever, and it won't be very helpful either. So the idea is that you notice whatever arises, including maybe even unhelpful things, with a friendly, kindly awareness. Yeah. Unless you are pretty distracted, in which case, keep coming back to the breath and the body, etc., etc., and work to stay aware. So what I was suggesting is that we do the metta-bhavana, particularly emphasising this receptive dimension, because often it gets forgotten. We forget it. So in the stages of the practice, in the first stage, when we're focusing on ourselves, all you need to do is turn towards your experience with a friendly awareness, provided you're not so distracted. In the second stage, you bring the friend to mind, and you turn towards them, and you just notice what happens when you turn towards them. Don't necessarily try and cultivate any metta, just notice what happens. So there's your friend, there's you, and see if anything arises. And take an interest. So if nothing arises, in a way that's interesting in itself, isn't it? Because here's somebody that you consider a friend. Actually, at the moment, there's no response. So take an interest in that. Notice that with friendly awareness. Don't tell yourself off. Or you might decide... you don't decide anything. You just stay patient and notice. You might find that there's metta there. If there is, turn towards that. If you turn towards metta with a friendly, appreciative awareness, it will grow. You might find that actually what's there is irritation. We'll turn towards that with a friendly awareness. Hold that. Don't fuel it. You don't have to fuel negative emotion. By fueling, what I mean is you don't have to tell yourself the story that feeds the irritation, but notice the sensations in the body. Notice the irritation in the body. There's normally a tightness and some sort of sense of contraction. Notice that and turn towards that with a friendly awareness. Don't tell yourself off for that. Do you see what I mean? So you literally just turn towards your experience in an intelligent, friendly, receptive, patient, non-judgmental, kind way. You do that with each of the stages, the neutral person, the person you find difficult, the enemy. Then you bring all four people into your mind together, and then you bring more and more people to mind, and you turn towards them and notice your experience. Now, as I hinted, what can happen is that sometimes you might find that metta is sort of spontaneously arising, there's a sense of goodwill. If that happens, then you can gently encourage it. Mainly you encourage it just by noticing it. But don't try and push it. Don't force it. Don't squeeze metta. Just turn towards it. If you want to, you can gently stimulate a little bit more metta by having a metaful thought or a metaful image. But don't force it. Mainly, just stay receptive. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, well, we'll do the practice. What we'll do is we'll settle down again. I'll read the Metta Sutta again. This time I'll use the feminine pronoun. So I'll talk about she who wants to cultivate metta. And then we'll move into the five stages in this very, very relaxed, open, as if there's nothing particularly you have to do kind of way. A very easy way. Yeah? Okay, very good. So, yeah, welcome back. I'll say a little bit more about meditation before we look at the Metta Sutta again. So, the meditation we've just done, I was emphasising particularly just becoming receptively aware of what's happening. But in the tea break, Katie was asking me, what do you do if, for example, you bring somebody to mind and you're not feeling better, in fact, you're feeling the opposite, you know, some sort of anger, ill will, aversion. Which, in the fourth stage, in a way, you're deliberately... I'm not saying you're trying to feel aversion, but you are bringing deliberately somebody to mind that you find difficult, if there is somebody. Traditionally, it's the enemy. So you're deliberately setting yourself a challenge in that fourth stage. So the first thing to say is, don't be surprised if what arises is some sort of aversion. You're trying to work with that emotional response. So the first thing is not to feel sort of like that's a failure. Do you see what I mean? If we felt no aversion ever, even towards those people that we find difficult, well, maybe the Metta-Bhavana practice wouldn't be so necessary. It is necessary because we're human and we do find that we have these responses of anger, hatred, resentment, hurt, aversion. And so, yes, the first thing to say is not to sort of be dismayed. And then, in this receptive dimension, what you're trying to do is you're trying to feel the feeling in the body, but let go of the narrative. I've sort of already said this, but I think it's really important to re-emphasize. It's the narrative, the story, the words in our mind that reinforce the blame, the anger, the hatred, whatever it is. So if you notice the words in your mind, the voice in your mind saying, they did this, she does this, whatever it is, if you notice a sort of replaying of a familiar story, what you're trying to do is let go of that and come back to the breath, come back to the body, just as you would in the mindfulness of breathing. Keep coming back. Without, again, telling yourself off, just keep coming back, letting go. But what you are trying to feel is the sensations in the body that are to do with that aversion. And then you can, if you can feel them, you can start to transform them. Actually, sometimes just feeling them in a friendly way, feeling the pain of that aversion in a friendly way, can start to release the sort of locked energy in that emotion. It can start to open something up. So for example, last Wednesday I was talking about how you were, or some of you might have been there, how sometimes our emotional responses are layered. There's whole sorts of layers, like they're stacked. So it's a bit like peeling an onion or something. So we bring somebody to mind and we might notice that there's anger or blame or something like that. If we let go of the narrative and just stay with the feeling, particularly the feeling in our body, sometimes what happens is that something opens up and we discover that underneath that anger there might be another layer. So for example, it could be fear. Sometimes we're frightened of a situation or a person or how they make us feel, and our response can be anger. Yeah, so it could be fear. And if you discover another layer like fear, well, then you try and sit with that with a friendly awareness. And that's not easy to do. It fears an uncomfortable emotion. But you try and sit with that, again, letting go of any narrative drive. Under the fear might be something else. There might be a sense of hurt, for example, and a sense that that hurt might happen again. Or it might be all sorts of things. It might be all sorts of things that layer our responses of aversion. You know, resentment might be there somewhere. There might be some sort of childhood memory, even, that surfaces. There can be a whole level of stacking. If you allow it to open up and unearth, then what's happening is all the energy that's tied up in those responses is being freed up. And that's really positive. That's really positive. You could say transformation's just happening just by you allowing yourself to experience whatever you need to experience. So that's one way of doing it. That's one way of doing it. But you can also work in a more active way. You can work in a more active way. And in a way, we're familiar with those active ways of working. You can start to try and, for example, broaden your perspective of this person. So, for example, you could remind yourself that they're just another human being like yourself. And yes, they've got these traits and qualities that you don't like or get you on your nerves, but they've probably got other qualities as well. They're not all bad. Maybe they are, but you could you could use your imagination to find something about them that isn't just negative. Or you could reflect a little bit more that the way that they get on your nerves or irritate you or make you angry is probably as much to do with you as them. If we get angry with somebody, probably there's some sort of button that they've pushed for us. What is it in us that has reacted? It's not always just one-sided. Sometimes, for example, they remind us of ourselves. Their qualities or their negative traits are traits that we sort of see in ourselves but don't really want to acknowledge. Yeah. So somebody, well, I won't go into them. You can sort of imagine. Or you can bring one of these phrases to mind, like may you be well, and see what happens. May you be well, may you be happy. In the sutta there's these phrases, isn't there? May all beings be happy and secure. You could bring a phrase to mind. What I was saying in the tea break, though, is sometimes I don't use actual words. If I'm relatively concentrated, I don't need to drop in a whole grammatically constructed sentence like, may you be happy. I just need to bring a sort of intention to mind that would translate to, may you be happy, but it's non-verbal. It's sort of pre-verbal. It's just a sort of motivation, orientation, intention. And then sometimes that's enough. You can cultivate metta in all sorts of ways, but what I'm trying to emphasise is that you do that on the basis of being really receptively aware. And the cultivation is quite subtle and quite light, rather than some sort of heavy, may you be well, may you be well, may you be well. And then you find that you just make yourself worse. You find yourself even more irritated or whatever. It's quite light. You do a little bit of cultivation and then you wait and you see what your response is. You go back into the receptive mode. You see if there's any difference in your feelings. You keep letting go of the story. And then you might drop in a little bit of cultivation again. And it might not be verbal, it could be an image. It could be just a felt sense. It could be some sort of motivation that you feel. Sometimes I bring the fact to mind that I'm going to die and that they're going to die. And do I really want to die feeling hatred towards this person? And also in the context of mortality, it's pretty petty. Most of our differences are pretty petty. They're sort of not really worth getting worked up about. Normally it's just that somebody has hurt our egotism and our ego is kind of bruised, so we want to get our own back. And if we kind of put it in the perspective of death, there are better things we could be doing with our life and our time than trying to play these games like kids play. So does that make sense? You can start to then bring in a more active cultivation but only on the basis of being really receptively aware and being patient and quite light with that cultivation. So let's just pause there and see if there are any questions about any of that, questions or comments that you might have. Yeah.
Now, when you say you bring someone to mind, do you visualise them as well?
You can do, but you don't have to.
No, I didn't know whether you...
Oh, me, myself. I'm not a very visual person. So I have a sort of sense of them. The visual dimension of that some comes and goes. For me, it's more like a felt sense of their presence. So I think different people are different. Some people are very visual, aren't they? Some people it's a bit more like a kinesthetic sense. So for me it's a bit like, even though you have your eyes closed, you know that you're in a room with other people, don't you? Not just because they're rustling or making noises, but you can sort of have a felt, intuitive sense that there are people around you, even though it's silent and your eyes are closed. That's a sort of kinesthetic, subtle sense that we have. And for me, it's a bit like that, that I'm in their presence, sitting with them. Yeah. Okay, shall we turn to the Metta Sutta? So last week, I was exploring the first kind of verse of this sutta, where the Buddha is talking about the conditions necessary for one who wants to cultivate this heart full of metta, this boundless heart. And the conditions are all to do with our ethical lives. You could say that it's all to do with ethics in our everyday life. So does anybody remember any of the words?
Upright.
Upright, yes. Upright. Can you say any more about what that connotes for you, John?
Well, there's a visual, I'm quite visual and I've got this sense of the poise and the being ready with poise is, is ready for the readiness for spontaneity.
Yeah.
And sort of noble and upright in all ethics.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's interesting. There's a sort of poise and readiness to act in an ethical way, but then also a nobility and an integrity, I guess, an ethical integrity. So they're not behaving in a duplicitous way. They're straightforward. So what you see is what you get. You know what you're dealing with. There aren't undercurrents and complexities. It's straightforward. So aspiring to be upright is, it's quite a thing, isn't it? That's the first thing that the Buddha talks about. We could just work on that in our lives, being more and more straightforward. I think what is implied there also is that if you're straightforward in the sort of way that is being advocated, that your heart is also sort of, your emotional responses are straightforward. Your heart can more easily open. If we're very caught up in complex ways of being that are, you know, slightly manipulative, we're always trying to get what we want from the other person without saying what we want, we're trying to manipulate life, then it's very difficult to just feel open-hearted and feel goodwill. So last week we talked about upright, we talked about noble speech, gentle and humble. We talked about those characteristics. I think the noble speech and the gentleness sort of compliment the uprightness, because the uprightness implies a sort of straightforward, straight talking kind of response. But straightforwardness and straight talking, if it's not balanced by noble speech and gentleness, can be a bit unkind and harsh. Yeah? So the Buddha's not saying you just want to be straight talking in that inconsiderate way. And the humble we talked about as well, it's just absence of egotism. It's not a false humility. It's not like Bhante is Bhante Sangharakshita. He's very aware of his impact. He's very aware of, I think, his place in the Buddhist world, in the sort of history of Buddhism. He's very aware of that he's a significant figure for people, but that doesn't need to be egotistical. Do you see what I mean? It's not egotistical in him. It's not self-serving. It's not all about making myself a bigger person in some way. It's not driven by sort of status or whatever. It's actually just very, very straightforward. So in that sense, it's humble. So contented is the next one. Contented. We talked a little bit about that, but what does that bring up for you? I mean, it's an obvious word. What do you think is significant about contentment and metta?
I think that we're not looking for more. We're not looking for the next thing.
Yeah.
It's very difficult if you're sort of distracted in meditation.
Yeah.
So it sort of does translate into your daily life. If you're distracted and looking for other things, then you're not really able to notice other people.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's craving that's going on, isn't it? It's some sort of craving, this wanting, whatever it is. And if we're constantly in the grip of that craving, then it's a very sort of, it's a very self-centered way of being in the world, whereas metta is a very outward way of being in the world. It sort of seems to be going completely against the flow of metta. You know, metta is more and more concerned with what can I give, how can I help, rather than what can I get, what do I want from this other person. Just read you a little bit of what Bhante says about contentment. Contentment is linked to individuality, in that if you are an individual, you don't need anything special to compensate for some lack within yourself. You have a being of your own. You are not unreasonably dependent on external circumstances or on the approval of others. You find a certain sufficiency or fulfillment within yourself, in the experience of your own being. It is in this sense that you are contented. So that's very good, isn't it? Not looking for others to compensate you for some sort of lack that you feel. Not looking for approval. So how do you achieve that? How do we become more contented, do you think?
Well, you said so yourself, by being more outward than inwards, maybe trying to help other people, listening to other people.
Right, yeah.
Generous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So generosity going outward. It's interesting, isn't it? If we focus more on other people, we'll be less concerned about what we might be lacking, if you see what I mean. And also there's a fulfillment that comes from that. When we are generous, there's a natural kind of sense of satisfaction that can arise. Yeah. Yeah.
To me, the contentment implies a kind of a certain amount of neutrality.
Yes.
And I think the desires and the cravings you were talking about earlier, I think, give you a certain direction, a certain kind of noise or interest in something.
Yeah.
And I think so my sense is to achieve that contentment,
yeah,
you need to be aware of those desires and then be able to recognise and step back.
Yeah. So, first of all, you need to know what you want. Is that what you're saying?
Be aware of the things which are drawing you, which are creating these desires.
Yeah.
Which may not be wholly bad, but...
Yeah.
Be aware when those are pulling you or pushing you.
Yeah. So I think awareness is key, actually, awareness of what is driving us, what's motivating us. And then you can start to choose a little bit, hopefully, like, do you want to be driven in this way or not?
Yeah.
Also, contentment isn't the same as complacency. Sometimes people kind of worry, I'm not saying that you're saying this, but people worry that if I get content with the world, then I won't want to change the world. I'll just be sort of complacent with my life and how it is and comfortably numb to everything around me. Sometimes people talk about how anger can fuel a desire for making the world a better place or changing something for the better.
I mean, is it the difference between acceptance and resignation?
Yeah.
I've heard that discussed before.
Mm.
That we think sometimes we think acceptance of the world is resigning to it.
Yeah. It's not. It's not the same. So contentment in this sense is not wanting to feel some sort of neurotic lack on the basis of feeling secure in the world. Then we can genuinely act to do something positive, to help create a better world, help somebody else, help other people. But it's not driven from lack so much as driven from a creative, positive, altruistic, meta, to make the world a better place. So I think that's really important, that contentment isn't complacency. I say that because popular images of Buddhism can confuse the two. So Buddhists can be perceived as being quite passive and content and therefore complacent. And it's not the same thing. Yeah.
I think the point I wanted to make is something similar to what's just been said.
Yeah.
And I was going to say being truthful to yourself.
How do you relate that to contentment? I mean, I think it's important.
If you're truthful to yourself, you're contented. It's when you don't really know yourself, I think, that there's a problem there. And you can't be contented.
Yeah.
I think once you're truthful to yourself, you're contented.
Yeah.
And that's where you'll come to help other people as well, basically.
Yeah. I have to think about that. I have to think about that more. But I think... something about knowing yourself is really, really important.
Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're driven in an unconscious way. So
you're driven by external things.
We're driven by external things. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, just thinking about knowing. I was thinking about knowing actually where you want to put your commitment.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Things that seem good.
Yeah.
But they can kind of distract them.
Yeah, they can.
Finding, something that important.
Yeah.
Or what the most important thing is.
Yeah.
And maybe we can live our life not really ever committing to what's most important.
Yeah, I think we can do. I think commitment has become a dirty word in our culture. And without commitment, actually were rootless in a certain sense and more likely to be blown around by whatever stimulus comes our way. And they might be lots of positive stimuli, that, you know, lots of good things that we could be doing with our life. And unless we're actually committed to something, we're likely to never really settle, and there's a lack of contentment in that. The grass is always greener on that, or I could be doing this, or no, I'll change my job and retrain in this, and then this. And I think that's fair enough, to a certain degree. So I'm not saying that we don't need to keep exploring and keep alive to changing circumstances and changing behaviours in our life, but it can become compulsive, can't it? Where somebody sticks at something for, I don't know, a year or two, and then they're changed again, and they're doing something else with their life, and you never really feel that there's the stability that contentment implies. So I think commitment is... but of course commitment is a sort of neutral word, in that it depends what you commit to, as to whether it's going to be a really skillful thing or not. You could be committed to something quite unskillful, and then that's not, you know, that's not going to help. But I know what you mean. I mean, you mean something, choosing something skillful. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, I'll take. Go on. Who? Yeah. No, go ahead.
I also think being always coming from a admiration to the point of view instead of being critical, and that's not just with yourself but with others as well. With everything. Because when you're being critical to others, it's like you're focusing on those bad things, and those bad things are probably things that you have as well. Because it's just reflection, really. Who you are.
But then isn't critical, do we not need to be critical in order to discern, to discriminate between what's helpful and unhelpful?
I mean, as in critical, as in like a sort of negative kind of
thing.
Looking at people and sort of, those shoes are terrible.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So I think you're right. I think if we can cultivate more of an appreciative response to others and the world around us, sort of appreciate, a bit more like the glass is half full, if we can cultivate an appreciative response, within that appreciative response, we can still hold criticism. But we're coming from a place where that criticism isn't the dominant response. Do you see what I mean? And I think that, that will lead to a greater sense of well-being and contentment. Yeah, I think there's lots and lots of things to appreciate all the time, and a lot of the time we miss what there is to appreciate because we're busy being critical. And that criticism can often stem, as you're implying, from a lack, an inner lack, a lack of contentment, a lack of contentment with ourselves sometimes. Yeah. So we're constantly sort of on the lookout, and somehow being critical of somebody else, we think, will make us feel better, don't we? Those shoes are terrible, somehow might improve my own shoes or whatever it is. That's probably not a great example, but you know what I mean, like criticising somebody else, and we think we become a bit more inflated as a result. And actually all of that is still based on lack. It's a very, very precarious place to feel good about yourself just because somebody else, because based on being critical of somebody else. It doesn't work, and it doesn't last very long, even if it works at all. Yeah. Just going to go to the back and I'll come back to you.
Right.
Yeah.
You were saying earlier that lack of contentment is kind of a state when you're trying to get things for itself.
Yeah.
And from my experience, my belief is that usually when you look to get something, it's just to fill a hole inside of you.
Fill a hole, yes.
Maybe it's an emotional hole caused by negative experience, or
yeah.
maybe a hole of something material, accepted by your peers or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And those holes, trying to fill it or not,
yeah.
it's not really something that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you're saying, how can we go into contempt? Being content.
Yeah.
From my view, is that just accept the fact that there's something there, there's a hole, there's a state inside of you.
Yeah.
And just focus on not feeling that hole, just accepting it, and then just focusing outwards.
Yeah.
And then whatever that you get, that rush, you get the feeling of I have that hole, I need to feel it.
Yeah.
Just notice it.
Yeah.
And try to accept it. And
Yeah, and that's very much in line with the Buddha's teaching, isn't it? That you notice the unsatisfactoriness of our experience, the dukkha in our experience, that hole, that lack that we feel. It does feel like a hole sometimes, doesn't it? It feels almost physically like there's this yearning, this hole, this unquenchable kind of thirst in our experience. And we don't really want to experience it, so what we do is reach for anything that will distract us from it, as if that bar of chocolate could fill that existential yearning for love, or whatever it is. And all it does is cover it over for a little bit, probably makes us feel even more discontent, or leads to some sort of neurotic, sort of addictive behaviour, where we keep reaching for that drink because we don't want to feel the lack. So yes, it's very, very difficult, but I think really important to sit with our discontent. We might not be able to just become content, well, we can't, but learning to sit with our discontent in a kindly way, being prepared to bear it, is part of the key to developing a more fulfilled life. Sometimes, in our current culture anyway, it's so easy to not sit with our discontent. I find it really difficult in London to sit with my discontent because there's always something to do. I can check my emails. I can, I don't know, turn on the computer and watch some rubbish, or pick up a book, or put some music, or go and talk to somebody, or have a coffee, have another drink, have whatever it is. There's so many ways in which we can distract ourselves. Very, very hard to sit with discontent. One of the things that I think is really good, if you can do it, is to do nothing every day, just for a few minutes, even 5 minutes, to sit in a chair and do nothing. Try it. It's not easy, but if you can do it, probably, first of all, you'll start to notice your discontent. And if you just stay with it, breathe into it, notice the bodily sensations, don't immediately get up and do something. Just sit for 5 minutes. I mean, in a way, that's what we're doing in meditation, at least when we're... particularly when we're doing just sitting. We're just sitting. But try it. Try it at home. Try it. And then extend that period, if you can, to 10 minutes. If you can't quite bear to do nothing, then make yourself a cup of tea and sit with a cup of tea. But no radio, no music, no telly, no emails, no phone, no, just sit. And it can start to just introduce a more spacious, content attitude to life, actually. Less driven, less lacking. We think that stimulus is what we need to fill that gap, but what happens is that we just run from stimulation to stimulation to stimulation. It just fuels more and more discontent. So, because we live in the world where, I don't know, we should be living like kings and queens, shouldn't we? Like royalty. There's so much riches. The technology that we've got is, you know, undreamt of in previous generations. All that luxurious, you know, the sort of comforts of life, even for people who don't have very much money, there's a great deal of comfort compared to how people lived just a few hundred years ago. Doesn't mean that we're more content. Yeah.
I just wanted to say something sort of on the kind of fringes of that. I liked what you said about, you know, just doing nothing. I often find, well, when I'm doing something, like for example doing a menial, fairly menial task, like washing up or some other example, ironing or something, I'll put on the radio or put on music.
Yeah.
And say, oh, this is going to be a really boring task.
That's why I do
so
that.
If I have some other things to distract my mind, it won't be as boring.
Yeah.
But actually having that other thing that you can't, that you try and then concentrate on, but you can't.
Yeah.
It makes the task more frustrating.
Yeah, it does.
You're not enjoying the task. You told yourself it's boring.
Yeah, you're not really listening to the music or whatever.
And you can't really focus on what you're trying to listen to.
That's right. That's right.
So it sort of makes it worse than just doing that thing and concentrating.
Yeah. Just doing that one thing.
Yeah.
And seeing if you can really enjoy it.
Yeah.
In the Life with Full Attention course, in Maitra Bandhu's course, what he advises is, he sort of says it's probably too much of a step to apply that principle of just doing what we're doing to everything in our life. But he says, choose one thing that you do every day, like cleaning your teeth or having a shower or whatever it is. Choose one quite contained thing. So I try and do it when I'm shaving. So sometimes, I mean, when I remember. And what I try and do is just stay with that experience of shaving or whatever it is, washing up, and actually feel all the sensations in your body as you're doing this very, very simple activity. And don't think about the next activity, the task, your whatever you're going to do. Don't, you know, just stay present as much as you can to that simple activity. Do that just with one activity a day, but choose that activity and stay with it. And what can happen is that mindfulness can start to create a bit more spaciousness in your mind that spills over. Yeah. I'll come back to you, Giuseppe. Irene had a question.
It was just a comment on the criticism of others.
Oh, yeah.
That.
Yeah.
And I was just like, it can create a lot of isolation, like that goes along with what you said. Like, you can feel better because you put down somebody else's attitude or something.
Yeah.
And then, in my experience, it's difficult to find the people you want to hang out with.
That's right. Yeah.
And actually, I was wondering if you can expand a little bit more on the positive, what you were saying, like a criticism that comes from a positive place.
Can I say a bit more on that? Well, I think, so I'm a very critical man myself, and I think that criticism isn't necessarily a bad faculty. If you can, it's a bit like having a knife. And a knife can be used skillfully to cut your vegetables, and you need a knife if you're going to make a nice meal. But it can also cut you and be very unskillful. So the critical edge in our mind is a bit like that. It dissects, it discriminates, it makes judgments. All of which can be necessary if you want to be intelligent about your life and your actions. But the more we are the more that critical faculty is alive in us, the more metta we need to hold it, so that we're using it skillfully. So I think it is all right to see people clearly, for example. It is even all right to see their faults. If we can also see their virtues, hold the two in perspective, and wish them well regardless of their faults. Do you see what I mean? Because metta isn't about becoming blind to the faults in other people. It's about wishing them well despite their faults. They're not perfect, but then we're not perfect either. So you can have that critical faculty, that critical awareness, and, well, in a way, it's necessary to have a critical faculty if we're not going to be completely gullible or silly about trusting people or, you know, naive. So the critical faculty is fine, but the more developed it is in us, the more metta we need to hold it. Yeah, the more it needs to be balanced with metta. Giuseppe.
Well, in a way, you just answered it, but I was thinking there's nothing wrong to make a statement towards somebody that you don't like, actually. If you had this kind of like thinking, say, oh, this person did that to me, blah, 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 after 5 minutes, I say, okay.
Yes.
To make a statement, that person is bad, that's it. So there's nothing wrong in doing that.
To them, you mean?
Yeah, like just to judge them. Just to stop the kind of thing. Just to make, for me, the person is shit or whatever. And you. But just to. Yeah, just make a statement. There's nothing wrong with that. Just to stop the kind of conversation in your mind.
If you're trying to stop the conversation in your mind, and it really does stop, then that might be all right, but there might be better ways of stopping that conversation. I think the main thing is that you stop that conversation in your mind, if you can. The thing with making a statement that's a very final statement, like they're bad, is that that can fix your perception of them. One of the things with metta is that you're trying to move beyond those rigid walls that we set up of fixed views.
Yeah, but not to excuse the person in a way.
No, you don't need to excuse them, that's right. So you can be quite aware of their unskillful behaviour, their faults, their failings.
Hold it, as you just said.
But you try and hold it. Yeah, you try and hold it. You can be aware of the harm that they've caused you, the hurt that they might have caused you. It might be right to be wary of going too near them again. That might be quite wise. So metta isn't foolish in the sense it doesn't kid we don't kid ourselves that everybody is equally loving and kind. You have to be intelligent about it. At the same time, you try and hold a bigger perspective. One of the qualities, I think, of seeing somebody with a metaful gaze, you could say, is that you try and see them as a changing process, as a growing living being that can change. We're all processes rather than things. We're all evolving. And when we fix somebody and say they are like this and they'll never change, we're doing them a disservice. And also it's not true. They may not change, but they are capable of change. They're more like a process. Yeah. I'll take one more, Jean, and then I want to.
I've been experiencing how important the quality of generosity is.
Yeah.
And even last night, I was really having difficulty wanting to retaliate when criticised.
Yeah.
And I just kept quiet I didn't manage to do anything very creative, but I didn't make things worse.
Sure.
So I kept quiet.
And that's really positive in itself.
Yeah. And I know really that if I do have time to reflect, then what I do want to do is what would be most helpful.
Mm.
And to say, to put something to this person in a way that would actually help them to move on. You know, because to retaliate, it's just tit for tat, and it doesn't help them. But to act generously and say something where I am, I have reflected on what I'm going to say, rather than just throw it back. I think the generosity can be felt in that by the other. You know, I could have been a lot worse.
And actually,
this morning what I managed was to say, well, I resented. I really burnt the rice, okay, but I wasn't allowed to forget that I burnt the rice. And I said, I was resentful about the whole rice thing, and that's why I found it difficult to talk to you. But I'll ring you tonight. So that's what I managed this morning. But I mean, God, I was so angry.
Yeah. Well, in saying that, what you did was you objectified things a bit, didn't you? You contained it so that you were clear about what was going on for you. And that's good. But yes, I think that's interesting, isn't it? It's those small things that we get really worked up about. When we step back, we realise how petty our anger is or resentment is. But in the moment, it's very, very hard not to, I don't know, just be sparked into rage at times, or hurt, or whatever it is.
Take it very personally.
Take it really, really personally, yeah. The other thing maybe I want to say about contentment, and then I'd like to finish with just a little bit of sitting. The other thing to say about contentment is that we can be, if we are able to be a little bit more careful about what sense input we let in into our lives. So just be aware of, you know, when you're wandering around London, you're being bombarded with adverts that are trying to make you discontent. So just notice where your gaze is. What information are you letting in? What images are you letting in? Yeah? Be careful of even reading the newspaper. The newspaper, depending on obviously which newspaper you read, but many newspapers, the news, is filled with stories that, have some factual basis, but will lead you to negative mental states if you're not careful. You have to be sort of intelligent about how you learn about the world. Notice what you watch on telly, or what sense inputs you're generally letting in. Alcohol. Just look at your kind of behaviour. If you do drink alcohol, it's likely to loosen your faculty of awareness. You're not going to be so aware, and then you're likely to not be able to be so careful as to what goes on in your mind, etc., etc. So sense input is really important if we're going to cultivate contentment. Be careful. It's called guarding the gates of the senses, guarding your senses a little bit, choosing to be wise about what sense input you let in. I think if you go, you know, if you step out of London, or even just go for a walk in the park, some sort of experience of natural beauty can lead to a feeling of contentment, or greater contentment. You feel something connected in you. So I think there are external things that you can do to cultivate contentment, or not do to cultivate contentment. Okay, let's end by just sitting for 5 or so minutes.